Welcome to Rebecca State of Mind. I'm your host, Rebecca, and this podcast is about life transitions, healing, identity shifts, mental health, spirituality, and so much more. With the mix of my personal stories, past and present, I bring in themes that have been part of my self-growth and self-discovery journey, and guests with similar themes. Through these stories and conversations, I will share my lessons, opinions, downloads, and things I care about that may hopefully help you in your growth journey as well. If you like what you hear, don't forget to follow, maybe leave a review, and come say hello on Instagram at Rebecca State of Mind. I'm also a certified Dharma coach, and my coaching Instagram is at Living Your Dharma. This podcast is meant for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only and is not meant as professional advice. Okay, everyone, this is episode 7. Wow. You know, I recently saw some stats and I don't know how accurate they are, and I've seen a couple different versions, but I read that 90% of podcasts don't get past episode 3. So I'm already in the top 10%, y'all, if that's true. And I read another statistic that said 80% of podcasts don't get to episode 10. But then I saw another statistic that said 90% of podcasts don't get to episode 10. So again, I'm not sure how accurate these numbers are, and I'm sure they were done in different ways at different times. But I think the point is a lot of people stop podcasting within the first 10 to 20 episodes. And it makes sense. This is a lot of work. I am actually surprised at how much work it has been. And it's not as easy as I thought it was going to be. And you know, I've had a YouTube channel for quite some time now, and I made YouTube videos years ago just for fun, for enjoyment, self-expression, and those gained traction pretty easily. Not like every single one, but I didn't really have to do anything. I just posted it. And honestly, I didn't even really care how many views I got, but some of them actually picked up traction. And some people like found me on Instagram and said they really liked my videos and stuff. So that was really cool. I wasn't even trying to go for that. With podcasting, I find that there's almost no way for it to gain traction. At least I don't know how it would gain traction. Like, I pretty much just share it with friends, colleagues, people I know. And the one that got the most listens so far was my second episode with my fellow Dharma coach, Farah, about are you an overachiever or a high achiever? So that one has gotten the most listens so far. And I don't even know how they got a lot of the listens. Maybe she's just continuing to share it with people. I'm not sure. But yeah, I find this really interesting because the way that I have found podcasts over the years is I'll just search a keyword and I'll find a podcast. And if it seems interesting to me, then I'll keep listening to it. Another way is I might just browse a category like spirituality. I think I've found a couple podcasts that way. But this podcast is under personal journals, and I'm not sure how people find personal journals or the reasons why people listen to personal journals. Now, I also don't think the category matters that much because I've listened to, you know, plenty of podcasts and I have no idea what category they would be in, but I'm guessing they would be like self-help, self-improvement, mental health, spirituality. I don't think any of them would have been in personal journals. But anyways, yeah, I guess I just wanted to share that. This has been a pretty interesting process so far. As we know, this is episode 7, and my podcast has been around for about 3 months now. I think February 6th was when I released my first episode. So the day I'm dropping this one will be May 6th, and that's 3 months. Yeah, so 3 months in, and I've been finding a lot of challenges and growth and learning with this process. And as you can see, I also changed up my intro for this episode. So this is still a developing process. And if you're listening and you have been listening since the first episode or any of the episodes, I really appreciate you, and I'm hoping I find a point with this podcast where things are smoother, I have a little bit more of a process going. This has been a lot of really great development and learning, and I'll probably switch up my intro a couple more times as I sort of really establish what the tone of this podcast will be. But the premise is, and has been, and will continue to be, at least for now, about my personal story, Dharma coaching, and things I care about. Those were the three pillars that I wanted to anchor this podcast in, and I talked about it in episode 3, my intro. So that's what it's going to continue being about, and it's just about forming the rest of it around those pillars and carrying it through with each episode. So yeah, just wanted to give y'all a little bit of an in on that. If you like to see the creation or process of something, this is it. It's happening right in front of you. You're listening to it happen in every episode. And I appreciate you so much for being on this journey and in this process with me. And if you are listening, I'd love to hear from you how you found this show. Do you listen to any other personal journal podcasts? And anything that you might have gotten from any of the 6 episodes so far? So I'd love to hear from you. Send me a DM at Rebecca State of Mind on Instagram and let's connect. Okay, so today we're going to pick up from episode 4, The Magic of Exploration. And I'm noticing I usually need at least 2 episodes between picking up between my stories because it actually takes a lot for me to dig back into my memory and it feels like I'm unearthing something each time. And it feels so good. It feels cathartic. And it's also something I need to like sit with for a while before jumping into the next chapter. So here we are, I'm ready, and this is part 2 of The Magic of Exploration. And I would say part 2 was about stepping into my greatness. So basically, part 1 of the exploration, I would say, lasted about 7 to 8 months, I think. It was a really mystical, magical time where I was pretty much directionless, and honestly, I loved it. It was exciting, but in the sense where I was a wandering soul. And what happened was, eventually, I went to what my destiny had pretty much been all along since I was a kid. And that was professional performing. Now, it didn't go there right away. What happened first was that I decided I was going to focus on dance. I had been a dancer since I was a child. I was always dancing around, took some dance classes. Then in middle school, I joined the drill team. In high school, I joined the song team, which is basically like the dance portion of the cheerleading team. We did a little cheer, but mostly dance. And it was part of the pep squad with flags and the mascot. So that's what I did in my freshman year of high school. And in high school, I got really serious about dance and I joined a dance company. So pretty much from age 14, I took dance pretty seriously. I continued with that dance company until I turned 18, and then I joined the adult company of the same company, which is the main dance company. But the biggest turn in my life that has pretty much shaped my entire adult life is that after I turned 18, I got into a form of dance, a subcategory called street dancing. You might have heard of some of these before. They're called locking, popping, whacking. They usually go under the umbrella of hip hop, but they're technically different. You could also call some of these styles club styles or funk styles. And I also went on to explore hip hop, voguing, house. I was doing hip hop choreography, but it's technically not really the pure form of hip hop. I won't get too much in the technicalities of everything. But basically, I went from being a choreography dancer, which I was doing in the dance company and when I was younger, to becoming a freestyle dancer. And this changed my life completely in practically every way. So that was a little background on my dance history. And I've talked about it in both of my story episodes so far, episodes 1 and 4, how I pretty much moved to New York for dance, and my life pretty much revolved around dance. And truthfully, I knew I was meant to dance professionally since I was a kid. I would always be learning dance routines from pop stars, music videos, and performances. The big one that comes to mind was Come On Over by Christina Aguilera, her VMA performance. Man, I loved that one. I was making my own routines in middle school and high school, and in high school I even choreographed and directed a whole number with three of my other classmates for our dance class, and we performed it at a show in our high school. So dance was always in my bones, and specifically I loved to perform. So part of me always knew, and you know, because of the conditioning of life, along the way I also knew, quote unquote knew, I had to get a real job, a professional job, and maybe on some level I thought I could like live a double life, where I was a working professional but also had a full dance life. And it's not impossible. There are many people in the dance world who have full-time professional jobs and do not pursue dance professionally, but they basically have a resume for dance. Either they live a lifestyle of dance, or they do passion projects or the occasional gig, but they maintain a stable job. But on some level, I always knew that I love performing. In my youth dance company in high school, and actually I started going to college when I was 16, like I talked about in my first episode. So when I was going to college, I was still in this youth dance company. But in that company, I was voted as best performer. So there was definitely something there. Okay, so back to living in New York. It's 2014. I've been working a bunch of different jobs. That was part one of the exploration. And like I said, part two was when I started moving towards my destiny as a dancer and started stepping into my greatness. But it started with choosing dance and deciding to focus on dance. So my memory is a little fuzzy, but I looked back at some old mementos, and I want to say it was around the summer of 2014 is when I decided I was going to focus on dance. And to me, that meant no longer hiding that this is what I want to do. And that includes, first and foremost, hiding from myself. And that showed up in a few different areas. It meant putting myself out there as someone getting headshots, going to auditions, when it came to teaching, being an authority in the art form. Because I had been studying locking for 6 years at that point, and I wouldn't even let myself teach. It's like I was hiding in the shadows, always staying in the learning and the exploring and being a student, because teaching meant I had responsibility and also opens me up to criticism and makes it less fun and more serious. Deciding to focus on dance also meant going out to a competition, which I generally didn't like that much anymore because it also made it less fun and more serious. And generally speaking, it's you trying to show other people that you're better than someone else. And that didn't quite motivate me. I was never a big competition dancer. In street dance, they're called battles. But a big part of this transition in not hiding anymore, and one of the biggest steps I took in doing this, was working at a dance studio. Another woman I knew in the dance scene in New York, her name was Robin. She was going to open a dance studio for street dancers in New York. I had actually booked her and her dance partner to teach and perform at my birthday party in Los Angeles before I moved to New York. It was also my going away party. So that was just a year earlier. So we knew each other, I would see her out and about, and she told me about this studio. And I expressed to her that I was interested in being involved, working there if she was looking for someone. And she did end up hiring me to work at the front desk at her studio. So in July, the dance studio opened, and that was my first job in New York in the dance scene. And right now I want to tie this back to the theme of exploration from episode 4, because it was really the exploration of all those different jobs that I had to like get out of my system before I landed on the thing that would mean the most to me. It's like I had to do all the things I wasn't so serious about before I could land on the thing I wanted to be really serious about. And I loved working at that dance studio. Not just any studio, but a street dance studio that was owned by a friend, a peer, someone I was in community with. It was a studio that I could also have ownership over, that I was so proud to be a part of, that I could claim as a home for myself as well. It was a space that was open for our street dance community, and I was so happy to be welcoming and holding that space for people. Other than the owner, Robin, I was the only other person who worked there. We would hang out, I could take free classes. Of course, I would use the studio space sometimes, usually just to stretch or maybe practice a little or hang out a little bit. And I would take care of the space, and it felt like home, and I just loved it. And Robin and I ended up becoming so close, we were like best friends in New York. So this was part of me taking my space in the community, claiming my identity, and saying, yes, I have a role here. Not just someone who participates by going to events and parties and maybe staying in the shadows, but someone who also holds space. And side note, this may be quite interesting, but my presence in New York was vastly different than my presence in Los Angeles. In LA, I knew everyone and I was everywhere. I was very extroverted. I did sometimes teach and perform. I threw events and parties. But in New York, it's like I was just fully in my exploration. And I almost enjoyed just being in the sidelines. This was also heavily influenced by some personal experiences I had in New York, but I won't get into them now. The point here is that choosing dance and taking my place in the community was coming out of that quiet, hidden, shadow, mysterious, anonymous place a little bit. So I believe the timeline would go something like this, from looking at old photos and messages and emails. I got my headshots in June. I started working at the dance studio called the Spot Dance Center in early July. There was a battle happening in DC in late July. I went out to DC to enter this battle. It's possible I hadn't entered a battle in like 3 years at that point. And I didn't make it past prelims. Again, I really wasn't a big battle dancer. But it was also more of a chance for me to just get back out in the dance scene as someone who's kind of serious, connect with my community. It was the funk style community in the East Coast slash DC area. And I generally would see these events as opportunities to connect with community as well, which wasn't true for everyone. A lot of people go to battles to win, of course, but I really wasn't that stuck on making it in the battle itself. And I think after I got back, it wasn't that long after that that I started teaching, locking specifically. It was at a different studio in the city, not the one I was working front desk at. So of all the dance styles, locking was really my specialty and the one I had studied and had the most knowledge and expertise in. I had always been really serious about locking and I knew a lot. I just didn't put myself out there as someone who teaches. And I kind of felt like I was being selfish with that history and knowledge as well and not sharing it with the community. So it's August. I was working at one studio, teaching at another. And I would also sometimes sub for locking at the spot where I was working front desk. And I was still working at the Korean fried chicken restaurant that I talked about in episode 4. It's possible I might have had another form of income. I feel like I was generally just always kind of hustling. But the big shift here was my focus was now on dance. And to be truthful, my focus always was dance in my heart. But it's like I was finally truly claiming it and not just saying that it's a passion or it's a lifestyle, but not my career. Now I was saying, no, it is a passion, it is a lifestyle, and it is also now something that I do for work, that I do for income. It wasn't a lot of income, but it was in the intention and the focus and the energy. I would sometimes prepare for an entire day just to teach a 1 or 1.5 hour class. That's if I was like teaching a routine or something. And for sure, those reasons that I had wanted to avoid teaching, you know, responsibility, criticism, all that, happened as soon as I started teaching. In the first couple weeks of me teaching, I received my first public criticism, or to be fair, I should say, a public correction. And also, to be fair, it probably wasn't ill-intentioned. It was actually from one of my teachers. He said I posted the wrong video as a reference for something I was going to teach in class. And that really bothered me. Not that he corrected me, but that he commented publicly on Facebook. I really wish he would have messaged me directly so I could, number one, take notice of the mistake and, of course, take it down and put up the correct video. But, you know, not everyone has that kind of internet etiquette, I suppose. I corrected myself publicly, of course, and I also messaged that teacher privately and said, hey, I would really appreciate if you message me directly going forward. And honestly, I don't remember us having that much contact after that. I think we must have at some point. But I have this feeling like our relationship actually changed after that. And it seemed so unnecessary. We were actually pretty close in terms of a teacher-student relationship. And it's just strange how something kind of out of left field like that could change a relationship. Look, I could be totally wrong in my perception. But that is my perception, to a degree. And that's just an example to show the reasons that I didn't want to get into teaching in the first place. Again, it pretty much showed up as soon as I started teaching. It was that level of responsibility, that opening myself to criticism, expending so much energy just to prepare for one class. It wasn't just having fun and being the student anymore. And you know, after getting past that initial blip, I had a really great teaching experience. I had so much fun in those classes. It's like teaching was fun, but it meant that dancing wasn't just fun anymore. I put together some really awesome routines that I'm still proud of to this day, and sometimes turned class into a whole production. I got to really share what I had learned over so many years, almost a decade actually, but I would say 6 years of really studying it. And I showed that I have something to share that is valuable, that I can contribute and adds value to the community. It's like I knew that, but I resisted stepping into it. Especially in New York, where there wasn't as much locking in the dance scene as there was in LA, because, quick dance history note, locking was created in Los Angeles. So basically, I was that LA person bringing locking knowledge to New York. But you know what it also showed me? It kind of confirmed to myself, especially looking back, that I'm not really meant to be a teacher either. Not that I can't teach, obviously I could, and the students really enjoyed it, but teaching was exhausting for me. It made sense that the feeling was kind of always there too. There was a reason I didn't really go towards teaching the way other people did. As a teacher, I don't think I should have to prepare for a whole day just to teach a class. I looked at a friend that I had in New York and other people I've known who could just walk into a room and start teaching, like 5 days a week. That seemed crazy to me. The amount of energy expenditure it would take me to do that would be like, I would be unable to do anything else for the whole week. And you know what I would end up drifting towards in my classes anyway? Was putting together little productions and performances in class. So even in class, it kind of went towards performance. And honestly, I felt like for me, teaching a class was a performance. Like while I was teaching class, I felt like I was also kind of performing. So I would say, going back to the theme of exploration, that this was now my exploration within dance itself, taking on new roles, trying them out and stepping into my greatness in all these little or big ways. The front desk position was great because it combined my love for dance and community with my other work skills and experiences like customer service, administrative, reception / front desk. It was honestly pretty perfect. Then going to a battle for the first time in years was confirmation that it wasn't really for me anymore. Which was helpful because as a street dancer, you kind of feel like you're supposed to battle in a way. Teaching was enjoyable and felt like I should have stepped into that level of responsibility, but I also saw that it was exhausting. And ultimately, what it led to for me, the thing that always came with the most ease for me, was performing. I was going on auditions, and I finally landed my first dance job. Well, kind of. It was definitely a performance job with dancing. I got it from a dance audition. I landed a job on a cruise ship as a costume character performer. And this was freaking exciting for me because most dance jobs wanted skilled technical dancers, whereas I was one of the rare hip-hop / street dancers going out to these auditions at that time. So the auditions were mostly practice for me, but then I got my first job. And although it wasn't a serious dance job in the sense where it was more for movers than dancers, it really was my first entrance into working as a performer professionally. So, in October, after just a few months of deciding to focus on dance, I was off to my first dance job ever and went to live on a cruise ship for 6 months. Well, at least that was the plan. Things didn't totally play out as expected, as is such in life, but I'll save that for the next story episode. Actually, maybe not the next one, because I kind of have this feeling I want to sort of add other layers of the narrative of this part of my timeline from a different angle or a different lens, or just highlight other layers. I'm not totally sure yet. But what I do know is that while I've been telling this story in these three episodes so far, is that it was actually a really multifaceted, multi-layered time of my life. There were some pretty major personal things going on for me. Like, while I was going through a lot of this stuff in New York, I was also experiencing a lot of emotional turmoil, and a lot of my understanding of myself was changing and developing. I was in my early to mid-20s. A lot of shit was happening for me. And I was really figuring out who I was in a lot of ways, especially out in this big city all by myself. So that's what's to come. And there's a message I want to share before we end today that's coming through for me. And it's a message about dharma, your soul's purpose. And that is, your dharma is what comes to you with ease. I thought at various points in my dance journey that I should be doing this or I should be doing that, such as competing, teaching, as I described, even though I always knew I loved performing. And it makes me think of how sometimes, or often, we let society dictate how we're supposed to show up in the world, even within the things we love the most or are most passionate about. We often put value into the struggle. Like, I could have definitely focused my energy on training for competitions, but I know my soul and spirit would have kept pulling me towards wanting to just have fun and explore. And actually, when I first started doing battles, it was fun and exploration for me. It was how I got to put my skills to the test and meet people. It was really fun. I noticed that once I started thinking about the outcome, that it wasn't fun anymore. With teaching, I told myself many times that if I just kept teaching, it would get easier and the preparation process would become faster. And maybe it did, or maybe it would have, but I didn't ever truly feel like I was in my flow with teaching the way I did with performing. In fact, I never had to find my flow with performing. I literally performed since I was a kid, either formally or informally. It was the gift I was born with. In a way, it was a superpower. No one ever really had to teach me to perform. Honestly, if I saw my kid like that, I would put them into performing arts school. So my message for you, the listener, today is that if there's something that comes easily to you, don't dismiss it as being less valuable than something you have to struggle for. Or you can think of it in the reverse, which is that if there is something that is a struggle or a challenge for you, that doesn't necessarily make it inherently more valuable than something that comes easily to you. In fact, I would offer or suggest that what comes most easily to you is probably the most valuable thing you can do or offer in this world. Now, that doesn't mean don't work on anything or improve yourself or take on any challenges. Like, definitely do all of that. But I think so often we shrug off or pass off things that come easily to us because there wasn't a struggle involved in it. Or like, because the world told you you're supposed to do the other thing that's more challenging, then we put so much value into working hard for that thing. And challenging is relative, right? Like for some dancers, they have a really natural drive to want to battle, which is like a whole different skill set than just dancing by itself. And for other dancers, teaching may come really natural to them, which is also a different type of skill. And for either of those people, performing or even picking up choreography might be what's really challenging for them. Now, of course, if the challenging thing is something you really want to do and you want to get good at and you love to do it and are super interested in it, then yeah, freaking go for it. And it doesn't mean that they're mutually exclusive. Doing the easy thing doesn't mean you can't also do the challenging thing or vice versa. Like, for example, for me, it doesn't mean I can't compete or I can't teach. I still do it from time to time, but I don't need to bust my ass and expend tons of energy to try and become good at it if I don't really want to do it. You know what I mean? It's more like I do it when I feel called to, or I do it when it feels aligned, or I want a challenge or some other reason. It can be like a small portion of the pie, of the totality of what makes up me as a dancer. Because really, there are so many ways to be a dancer. I might even make a whole episode on it at some point. But it's not necessarily dancing for you. It could be something else, anything. Do the thing you love. Do the thing you enjoy. And also, don't devalue the thing you're naturally good at. Maybe it's the same thing. I think a lot of times it is the same thing. What you're naturally good at is probably what you enjoy. So anyway, I'll end it there. If you are in a stage where you feel that you're ready to step into your greatness, then it might be time to look at what natural gifts may be waiting for you to pay attention to them. If you're still in the exploring, that's beautiful. I highly encourage it. And I'm excited for you to eventually find where your greatness lies. I think oftentimes we know what that is, but if you're like me, you might have had to just get the other things out of your system first. Okay, y'all, that's it for today's story. Thank you so much for listening. I feel like I'm really getting to the good stuff. And I'm going to start bringing in guests that are aligned with or have been part of my dance journey as well. As always, we'll be talking about the themes that are coming up in my stories. And hopefully in these conversations and stories, you'll be able to find the golden nuggets that resonate with you. On that note, if anything in this episode did resonate with you, I'd love to hear from you. So if it sparked something in you, maybe it got you thinking about a gift that you might have been ignoring or pushing aside. Maybe you feel you've been at that brink where you're ready to start stepping into your greatness. I'll add here too that this is a really big part of Dharma and Dharma coaching. If this is something you want to explore further with a coach, maybe open it up and sort out all the different parts. It could be what is blocking you or even getting clear on what these gifts are for you. Then definitely contact me to set up a discovery call for Dharma coaching. Right now, I am offering a 3-month Dharma discovery package where we fully dive into these topics such as your gifts and your natural superpowers and what might be blocking you from fully stepping into them. This will be 3 months of one-on-one coaching with me. People have already started their packages and we are doing some really amazing work. The doors to enroll for this package are open for 10 more days until May 16th. So I'll be taking discovery calls until May 16th. So contact me on Instagram at livingyourdharma. I'll also put them in the show notes. Or email me at livingyourdharma@mail.com. Not Gmail, just mail.com. Even if you might not be able to enroll this time around, I recommend just contacting me for more information because I do always have some type of offering going on, and I will probably be offering another Dharma Discovery package later this year, probably in the fall. I don't have an exact date yet, but yes, if you are interested, even if you can't enroll this time around, do contact me anyway. Again, I'll put all the info in the show notes. Connect with me on Instagram at Rebecca State of Mind. If you're interested in coaching specifically, DM me at Living Your Dharma on Instagram, or email me at livingyourdharma@mail.com. All right, y'all, this has been a blast. I wish you all a wonderful May, and I'll see you again in 2 weeks with another special guest. Have a great day.